Welcome to The Other Side of the Plate, brought to you by Feast, families empowered and supporting treatment of eating disorders. This podcast is for moms, dads, and caregivers searching for answers, the kind that can feel so hard to find when your loved one has an eating disorder. I'm Jenny, and along with my co-host Laura, we're here as caregivers with lived experience who supported our loved ones through an eating disorder. Together, we'll share personal insights, connect you with professionals, and point you toward helpful resources. And as we say at Feast, we're here because we've been there. The content contained in this podcast is not a substitute for professional or medical treatment, and it may not represent the views and beliefs of Feast. Always consult a medical professional for medical advice and treatment recommendations. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Other Side of the Plate podcast. I'm Jenny Gaines, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Cohen.
Hello.
We're joined today by Natalia Trees, who's going to talk to us about a specific eating disorder diagnosis, one that can be confusing for caregivers and clinicians, and that's ARFID, Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. Natalia is a certified eating disorder registered dietitian and consultant, specializing in the treatment of adults and adolescents with eating disorders. She was granted a Bachelor of Science from the University of Colorado and a Master of Science in Clinical Nutrition from Tufts University. She completed her dietetics internship at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Natalia's experience spans over 15 years in medical nutrition therapy, nutrition education, public speaking, and eating disorder-related research. Her passion is advocacy, training, and education for current and future dietitians, and helping individuals rebuild their relationship with food. Welcome, Natalia. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So let's get started with one silly, you know, I always like to do some type of icebreaker. Do you have any new fun hobbies? I feel like that's like a big thing people are talking about now.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for bringing that up. Actually, my new hobby is that I've just gotten into bread making. So last night I made my first loaf of bread on Saturday. It was like rosemary bread. And then last night I made this honey vanilla bread loaf and a jalapeno cheddar to go with this chili that I was making because, you know, it's cold. It was cold here last night. It was -2 in Denver. So that's my new hobby is bread making.
Love that. Love that. Is it sourdough or just bread?
No, I'm not that skilled. Okay. I have not done the sourdough starter yet.
I'm right there because I was making challah. Like, that's my new obsession. So I've been into bread making as well. So very, very, very love it. Okay, so now we broke the ice. Now we can just jump right into it.
Now we can. Oh, all the different ones you made sound so good. I'm going to have to try some of those.
The vanilla one.
Okay, we'll get down to business now. And we know, Natalia, that ARFID stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. But how would you define it in plain language?
Yeah, so ARFID basically just means that a person is struggling to eat enough food to be able to keep up with their nutritional demands. And with ARFID in particular, this impacts not only growth and development, but also their ability to engage in their daily life. And there are several different presentations when it comes to ARFID. There are three types. So the first one is sensory sensitivity. And this basically means that folks do not consume enough food or avoid particular food groups based on the characteristics of the food. Things like smell, taste, temperature, texture is probably a big one that folks have heard of. So that means that they are avoidant of those particular foods. Those foods expand into larger food groups, and then the amounts of food that they're able to consume become so small that they are not able to keep up with their nutritional needs. The second presentation with ARFID is fear of aversive consequences. This just basically means that those who are struggling to eat foods that they might have had some sort of negative or fearful or harmful reaction with. So this might be like choking, maybe vomiting from an illness that they might have associated with a food group, but that leads them to not be able to eat the food. Therefore, they're not meeting their nutritional needs and it's starting to impact their growth and development. And then the last presentation is lack of interest. This basically means exactly as it sounds. This means that folks with this type of ARFID are really not interested in food. They don't have hunger fullness cues. They find eating and food to be a chore. And really, they just struggle so much to be able to just meet their basic nutritional needs because they forget to eat and they're not interested in it.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that. It sounds so different than what I'm used to because my daughter had anorexia, but there are also some similarities in that they're avoiding food and restricting what they eat. So could you tell us what is different about ARFID compared to bulimia, to anorexia, and to other like anxiety-related eating problems?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the biggest difference between ARFID and other types of eating disorders is that the avoidance or the inability to consume enough nutrition and the weight loss that is associated with that is typically not driven by body image or body dissatisfaction. Now, I'll just say that in this culture, there is normative amounts of body image distress just in the society that we live in. So to say that somebody with ARFID to have zero body image distress isn't actually a fair assumption, but their behaviors, so the reason why they avoid the foods, the reason why they restrict their intake is not to drive thinness. It's not because they want to change their body weight, shape, or size. And typically, folks with ARFID, they actually want to gain weight because they do feel like they're quote unquote not normal looking, or they have not normal eating patterns. And so a lot of the desire of somebody with ARFID is, I want to be quote normal again. And then when we're talking about anxiety-related disorders, typically anxiety-related disorders are that anxiety rises to something that occurs and it is temporary. But with ARFID, you know, this anxiety is kind of present all the time because we have to be eating all of the time. And so, yes, the anxiety and distress, you know, it involves the plate and it involves the table. So it makes it different than somebody with an anxiety disorder who might be just fearful or anxious around social settings. So they can, you know, limit that by not socializing. But with ARFID, that distress is all the time, and it starts to impact their nutritional status. They start to lose weight. They start not to grow appropriately, and malnutrition kicks in. And that's when we need to be concerned.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. What stood out to me on that was that someone with ARFID is actually motivated to get better, it sounds like. And that looks a lot different than anorexia. So even though they have all of that anxiety and distress, they have that motivation to either for social reasons or for appearance reasons, wanting to normalize their eating.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, I talked about the different presentations as if somebody couldn't have all three of those presentations. Just FYI, somebody with ARFID can have all three of them, one or two of them. So oftentimes, you know, when I'm doing an assessment of somebody with ARFID and I'm trying to figure out my treatment strategy, and so I'm going to look at maybe what their presentation is, try to go with the most dominant presentation. And motivation is typically there, but the distress and the avoidance is so high that it's often just as challenging as treating any other eating disorder because, you know, nobody wants to feel anxious and horrible. And so it makes sense why we avoid, right? It makes sense why we would not want to eat that particular food or that particular food group or want to address that, because I don't want to feel that disgust that might come up from the texture of the food, or I don't want to feel that feeling of choking if I had a previous choking experience with something that I was eating. So the distress and the anxiety and the motivation is there, but so is the anxiety. And that's, I think, what makes the treatment of ARFID so challenging.
Yeah. I remember like in practice seeing, you know, kiddos who would come in with so much, like they wanted to be there, right? They were driven, they were in it. And maybe first week, second week, first couple sessions, like so in it that all of a sudden it was like, I'm good, right? Because that anxiety just gets so high of having to do that hard thing. And that was always really, really challenging. And kind of along those lines, how do you determine, you know, between someone having normal picky eating? Like one of my daughters, when she was younger, literally until kindergarten, first grade, it was pulling teeth. As a former dietitian, it drove me crazy. I was like, why can't this kid eat? Like, we love food in our house, and she would eat nothing. So where, and I didn't know what ARFID was back then, but where, and now she eats beautifully. So would have really fallen in that picky, and I don't know what happened, but between that picky eating, because she would have been characterized as ARFID, but where would you find that fine line of picky eating or someone has a true diagnosis of ARFID?
Yeah. I'm sure every parent on this podcast is like, same, we've been there. A picky eating. It's so common. It happens all the time. To your point, you'll have kids that'll be like, you know what? I'm not interested in that anymore. You'll have kids that'll be like, I want to eat the same lunch every day for months and months and months. And then they're like, I'm over that. I think the biggest differentiator between picky eating and ARFID is really around the nutritional status piece and the engagement in the daily life. So the biggest thing I will say is that picky eating is normal. It happens. If it starts to impact how they're growing, so your kiddo starts falling off the growth curve, they're not gaining weight appropriately, they're not gaining height the way that they should be, that's when we need to be concerned. And that's when we want to start raising a little bit of a red flag there. Similarly, if they're really unable to start to engage in all the things that they used to be able to do, birthday parties, sporting events, school functions, you know, things like that, if they're starting to pull back from that because they're not taking in enough nutrition or because the event surrounds nutrition, that's when we want to start to raise the flag. So picky eating, normal, happens. That is temporary. ARFID is not a phase. It is not a temporary thing that just goes away. It's a brain-based illness, just like anorexia, just like bulimia, and we need to treat it as such, and we need to make sure that we're getting that early intervention in some way, because we know that early intervention produces better outcomes.
Yeah, and definitely even as the kiddo gets a little bit older and they're aware how different their eating is than their peers, start to become a little more independent, and they can't go over Sally's house or right. Ben's house because there's nothing for them to eat. That also gets really challenging. So let's say, you know, you're a parent and you're listening to this and you're like, yeah, I think that my kiddo is so much more than just picky eating. What would you say would be the first step for a caregiver to do?
Yeah, I would definitely consult with your pediatrician. So I would ask the pediatrician, if it were me with my kid, I would say, hey, can we look at these growth curves together? And can we start to analyze what's happening here? Can you project forward for me in 6 months? Like, where should my kid be from a growth perspective? And are you worried that this is, you know, the weight gain's not happening or the height isn't happening? And, you know, I think in our healthcare system, we have to be our best advocates. So really being persistent there, if the pediatrician is like, yeah, I see we're falling a little bit behind, well, what would you recommend? Do you recommend that maybe we seek consultation with the dietitian who can help us figure out how we can get in more calories or how we can support this growth process? You know, can we do a screening for ARFID? There are lots of different ARFID screening tools. You know, unfortunately, I think it's becoming more and more relevant now. More pediatricians are aware of eating disorders, which is great. I think that speaks to the advocacy in this podcast and the advocacy with folks out in the community. But there's more and more education going to practitioners, which is great. And ARFID is still a little bit behind here. So not everybody knows that there are particular screening tools for ARFID. So if your pediatrician doesn't know what you're talking about, ask to see if we can, you know, talk to a specialist, a feeding specialist, or somebody else who might have a little bit more knowledge as to what's happening here so that you can get the tools that you need. You know, there's no harm in asking. And really we have to be the advocates in our healthcare system. So step one, talk to your pediatrician. If the growth, you know, if you're following up and you know, the growth curves, like you're noticing more and more that we're still not making the traction that we want to, ask for a referral for a dietitian, ask for a referral if there's feeding clinics, you know, and go from there and do the screening for ARFID. There are lots of different screening tools out there right now.
Yeah, that's great. And definitely learning to be your own advocate, because you may ask for a referral to a dietitian and it's altogether possible to refer to a dietitian who really doesn't know about ARFID too.
Yeah, so true.
Really, there's so much information. I mean, Feast, you know, we're definitely going to put some stuff in the show notes, but knowing what you're talking about, even though you want your providers to be the specialists, that's unfortunately not always the case, you know, to your point. So going and knowing the questions that you're going to ask, which we're going to get into a little bit, and podcasts like this are so awesome to really educate the caregivers, because as I said, the field is just behind and it is what it is, right? You may love your pediatrician and this may not be something that, you know, they know much about, or they may not refer you to somebody. So, but there are specialists out there. So, yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully now that you've talked so much about it, Natalia, the listeners are able to recognize when their child may have ARFID and want to seek out those specialists. I know that might not be a straight path for them, but let's just say they are able to connect with the professionals that you talked about. What would treatment look like from that point?
Yeah. And I spoke to this a lot in the webinar that I just did, but you know, the basics of treatment here kind of depend on the severity and where they are at in their recovery process. So first and foremost, we want to make sure that we have the foundation of nutrition rehabilitation. This is key. So if assuming there's been a lack of growth and development, we need to support weight gain. That's the piece that we're going to work on first. So that's getting calories up. Whether, you know, what type of foods, probably the preferred or safe foods is some terms that you all may have heard in the treatment of ARFID. So we're talking volume here. So we're getting enough volume of the safe or preferred foods. And that's okay if it's just mac and cheese and grilled cheese and quesadillas. If that's what we got to get in, that's what we're going to get in. But we want to make sure that we're getting in enough volume to support the weight gain and the nutrition stabilization, because there's no way we can do variety or food trials or food exposures if we're trying to do all of that on an empty tank. So, you know, the whole point, the therapies behind ARFID, whether you call it exposure therapy or food exploration therapy or feeding therapies, the whole point of them is to create new neuropathways in the brain so that your loved one can create a different experience with that food. It's not meant to get in the calories. The food trials are not meant to do that. That's why we have to have the foundation of the meal plan. The exposure therapy is to retrain the brain. We cannot retrain the brain if it's not appropriately nourished. So foundation is nutrition rehabilitation, and then we add in to the exposures, the feeding therapy, and the food trials. A lot of times, adults and adolescents, they want to do the variety first. They do, because they want to be back to normal. They don't want to be just like that kid at the party who can't eat the pizza and who's just over there having their packed sandwich. They don't want to be that kid. They want to be the kid that's enjoying the pizza, that's there with their friends. And so we get really excited when there's motivation to do that. But the brain is like on fire when we're trying to do it. And if it's not appropriately nourished, we're not going to get the outcome we hope for. So I always tell folks the beginning of treatment has to have that foundational layer. In every consultation I've done, I'm like, are they gaining weight? Are they eating enough to sustain the weight gain? If the answers are yes, then yep, we can move into food trials. And food trials are tough. You know, they're not easy. There's a lot of back and forth with food trials. And it's exciting, and it's where the bulk of the work is, but we have to make sure we level set that foundational piece.
Is there a certain amount of weight gain that you look for weekly with ARFID like you would with anorexia?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. And I talked about this in the webinar as well. And I think it depends on the level of care and the kind of structure you have, because you want to make sure that the weight gain, you know, is done safely and appropriately, and making sure that we're not going too quickly and, you know, throwing people into refeeding, just like you would worry about that with anorexia or other types of eating disorders. But, you know, I would say even on an outpatient basis, like 2 to 3 pounds a week is great, especially if you have a kid who's really far behind on their growth and development. So I was just doing a consult on for a team at Montanito, and we were kind of talking through looking at growth curves together. And, you know, this kid is probably growth and developmentally, they're currently 12, but where they are on their growth curve is 7. So we have to just, you know, work with that and know that we've got to get their weight gain up. They're pretty height suppressed. So we see a lot of height stunting, especially in ARFID. And for a lot of reasons that we talked about, just a lot of folks don't know what they don't know. They don't realize that my kid's behind. They're kind of used to the always having the small nugget in the family. And they don't realize that, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that they're malnourished. And it's not for a lack of trying, but that's where we have to start. So I was telling the team, we got us 3 pounds a week minimum, because they're in a residential setting. So I said 3 pounds a week minimum, so we can get that momentum going. And then in a couple of weeks, we can start with food trials. We don't want to wait so long that we're kind of avoiding the process, but we do want to make sure that we're on the appropriate trajectory to be able to do that cognitive piece.
I want to take a step back with that, because I hear you, you know, yes, they have to you know, become nutritionally rehabilitation. They need to gain the weight. If, you know, they're off their growth curve, they're underweight, all the things. And a parent may be like, well, that's great, but I don't understand why we can't start. So what I'm asking is, when a brain is malnourished, right, what happens, right? So, I mean, that I know it's the inflexibility, you know, they have a hard time with all of that. But can you touch upon that? Because I think that's something that if you're not in the field or have gone through it or have the specialty to really understand what happens in the malnourished brain, how it's so hard to do the food trials, like what makes it so hard besides they're underweight?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yes. So a malnourished brain is literally, like I said before, it's somewhat on fire, and it kind of gets locked into these patterns where it's going to feel the most safe. And so everything around them kind of starts to feel a little bit more unsafe.
Like their anxiety is higher.
Yep. Their anxiety is higher. Their rigidity is higher because they want to fall into patterns that they know and that they can predict. So if something is new, but that's a new learning materials in school, social situation, learning a new skill, all of that starts to feel unsafe because they cannot predict what the outcome will be. So a malnourished brain gets more rigid. Like you mentioned, it gets kind of stuck in the same exact patterns and it doesn't want to veer from the patterns. And it feeds, no pun intended, into that avoidance piece where it always wants to stay in its kind of like safe comfort zone. And then eventually, very little things become safe. And so everything starts to become unsafe. And then that's where you start to see that anxiety really start to escalate. And that's where you might see it at the table. So, you know, if a kiddo was once able to tolerate having meatloaf on the table and now they can't even smell meatloaf, they're screaming at you because you cooked meatloaf in the house today. That is because their malnourished brain is kind of locked into place around this rigidity. So, you know, as parents, like you'll see this with time, a more malnourished brain, the anxiety, the escalation, you'll see it. It starts to play out in the home. So.
Yeah. Thank you for going back a little bit to explain that. I always want to like think back, what don't I know? Right. Like I know this, but then what's that parent is like, wait, I don't understand. Why can't we just start trying food, you know, either weight or whatever it is. So I think that that's important to explain that what's going on in the brain. And I think another thing, and I remember when I started working and seeing a lot of families with ARFID, and I even grappled with this question, is what does success look like? Because I think a lot of parents think, or caregivers, understandably, okay, well, my loved one is going to, we're going into treatment for ARFID, and in X amount of time, they're going to be able to eat everything. Like there's in everything in the world, they're going to be the most adventurous eater because this is what we're going to do. But could we have a reality check of what typical, like what would you say would be successful in ARFID treatment?
Yeah. And this is what I will say to everybody who's listening. What is success? It is all of the small things that we sometimes forget to acknowledge. So it is weight gain. So if weight gain is needed, which 99% of the time it is in ARFID, that is a success because that in and of itself is so hard. So huge success. A big success, the example I just used about the meatloaf. So if they can then tolerate the meatloaf in the house, huge success. If before, if they could not. Success is, you know, maybe they're starting to talk more openly about the food that they once had a negative experience with. So now they can just start talking about that experience and the food around it. That's a success. So it's kind of all of these small things that when you're in it, you forget about, but it's important. And that's, you know, I really want to also say like my push here for an outside treatment team, just as an additional form of support, like that's where your treatment team comes in too, to help remind everybody to be able to acknowledge those successes, to say, hey, this was a good week. You know, they gained weight. You were able to cook meatloaf. Yeah, I'm sorry, it didn't get on the plate. We'll work for that next week. But you were able to cook it in the house and you didn't have a meltdown at the table. Like those are major successes this week. And we should all feel really proud of this work because this work is exhausting. It is two steps forward, step back, three steps forward, two steps back. And it, you know, it can feel like, oh my gosh, is this ever going to end? And it will, and things will get better, but it takes time.
Yeah, I think it's so important to no pun intended again, to set the table, right? Yeah. So, to let a family know what it's going to look like. I worked with a family that the kiddo was absolutely, and I don't know where it came from. I don't think we knew where it came from, but was absolutely terrified of round foods. So if there was a grape tomato, if there was a garbanzo beans, anything like that in the vicinity, she would just go, she just couldn't handle it. And one of the successes, you know, God forbid she puts it in her mouth, but if she could just be in the house with a grape tomato.
Yeah.
So that's success, right? Eventually, I think she did eventually try some round foods, but it was such an aversion to round food. So thank you for level setting that for us.
Of course. Yeah,
I love all the examples you gave, Natalia, because it is so hard to just be looking like at the finish line, whatever eating disorder it might be. But I'm assuming with ARFID, especially so, to just remember to keep track and celebrate each small success so that you can see that you're moving forward. I think that was one of the most helpful things for me. I just had like a little notebook and maybe my daughter smiled. Maybe she wasn't eating well that day, but she smiled. I would write that down. Yeah. If she took an extra bite, I would write that down. If she, you know, did anything at all that I thought I'm really searching for progress here, but if it felt like anything different than what we started out with, it really helped me not get discouraged. So I'm glad you brought up all of those examples. And you also brought up what my experience was with anorexia, it not being linear, the path to recovery, absolutely not linear, and the steps forward and back that you talked about. I'm wondering if you'll share with the listeners what some common setbacks with ARFID are and maybe some tips on how they can respond.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think common setbacks are all the things that you probably know and think about, but they show up so much within ARFID. So with an ARFID treatment, we're really trying to create structure and predictable times, right? So we want to make sure that we're feeding around the clock at predictable times, that we're sitting down and making sure we're getting in that nutrition. So what are some setbacks that happen with that? Travel, sports schedules, sleepovers, you know, anything where it's going to maybe disrupt the time schedule. So maybe you're traveling, you know, we're coming out of the holidays, we're into January now, but let's say you were traveling for the holidays. I mean, now your whole meal schedule is out the window because you've got other family members maybe in the house, or you're visiting, you're staying somewhere else. And so it can feel really jolting when you travel and when you kind of get off of the eating schedule. Another big one, and this I would say for ARFID with fear of aversive consequences, illness. We are in illness season. And so if your kiddo gets sick and they have a fear of getting sick, whether that's getting sick related to food or even just a cold, there goes any appetite. So somebody just, you know, if they have the flu, they're not interested in eating. Somebody gets a GI bug that goes around, that's certainly going to impact things. So, you know, I think setbacks there are just trying to get back on track with that schedule, trying to validate the feelings, because it is true. When you're sick, you don't feel good and you probably don't feel like eating, and you have to eat anyway. So, you know, I think those are like the two big common setbacks. And then I think just fatigue, like just getting tired, like whether that's fatigue of the food. So let's say that they're, you know, they've been eating their preferred foods for a while and they're gaining weight on it. But guess what? Those preferred foods or those safe foods, now they're like, I don't want to just eat quesadillas. I'm over quesadillas. So now you only have, you know, four more meals left in your, you know, in your toolbox to be able to support them with. So, you know, just fatigue there can cause a lot of setbacks. And also it just leads to that exhaustion and feeling like, oh man, am I going to be able to do this again? Like I have been really, it took me this long just to get them to eat the quesadilla and now I can't even get them to look at it. So those I would say are the big setbacks.
Yeah. That makes so, oh my gosh, so much sense. It's like, oh gosh, that was their only food that they were safe with and it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've traveled to 7 supermarkets to make sure you have the exact brand of yogurt and now it's stocked in your house. Because that is another typical ARFID thing, is it's that very exact brand, way it's cooked, everything, which makes perfect sense when you think about it, because then you know what you're getting, right?
Right.
So I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. We've talked about having a treatment team. Like you've said that before, getting your outpatient treatment team. You know, when the three of us sit here, we're like, oh yeah, we know what that is. but our listeners may not know what that means. Like, what would, who would be on a typical treatment team for someone who's getting some treatment for ARFID, and what roles would they play?
Yeah, great question. So pediatrician is a big one, and you know, they're really going to be the first probably set of eyes on your loved one if you're worried about them with ARFID. So pediatrician. From there, I would say dietitian. We talked about this. I, of course, am a dietitian. So that's where I'm going to talk about first. So the role of the dietitian really is to support with the nutritional status. So that is to make sure that your loved one is getting in enough nutrition to support their growth and development. And if they're not, what are we going to do about it? So they're going to create what we call meal plans. They might help you create like a food list, grocery list, things to have in the house. And readily available. They might support with supplements. So, you know, it is very common with folks with ARFID who might need a nutritional supplement that would be like Ensure, Boost, you know, there's Breeze or juices, smoothies, like things like that to be able to get in calories when you're either on the go or you just need to add in something extra to get the calories up. So the dietitian's really going to work with you all and your kiddo around that. And then once we've got the meal plan stabilized, we've got the growth starting to move, the dietitian can also start to work with the exposures, with the food trials. And this leads me into the third member of your team, which would be the therapist. So really in conjunction with the therapist, the dietitian and the therapist will kind of work on the anxiety management or the distress tolerance skill building. And this is, you know, the foundation of ARFID treatment, which is really around tolerating the distress that comes up when eating. So if you think about it, the RD is going to be the one to maybe tackle the foods that we're going to think about for the food trials. And the therapist might be the person to tackle what skills are we going to use with both in with the family and with the kid to be able to manage that, that table and to be able to manage how we're eating together. So, and then, you know, there are several other team members that I think often are wonderful on an ARFID treatment team, but not always readily available. One being an occupational therapist. So occupational therapy, they can really work on some of the feeding, if there's any feeding difficulties, like oral motor skills. And they're in conjunction to the therapist with anxiety management, distress tolerance, and in conjunction with the dietitian around the nutrition. But they're going to be skill-based in some what's happening inside the chewing process, the swallowing process, that type of thing. And then, you know, lastly, psychiatrists, amazing to have a psychiatrist who can help support with any psychiatric comorbidities. You know, often folks with ARFID have other types of psychiatric illnesses like anxiety disorders, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder. So, you know, a psychiatrist can certainly help there with medication management. But again, these are, you know, not everybody has access to that. And we, you know, and so I think, you know, I think the really the core of the team is the pediatrician, dietitian, and therapist to be able to kind of work on the foundational pieces of the treatment interventions.
Yeah. Yeah. I love all of that. And I will add to that, being in the role that I sit in over here, is as a parent going through it and sitting across the table from your loved one who's in so much distress, what happens to the parent, right? We get so anxious. Mm-hmm. And we're so anxious and we don't want to do it. They can feel our anxiety. Even if we're trying to fake it, they can feel it. And finding a way for the caregiver to even learn some of those distress tolerance skills is absolutely so helpful. Because we have to know that their anxiety isn't going to hurt them, right? And your anxiety and how to manage all of that from the caregiver point of view. And when caregivers need that time out or they need to tap in with someone else to help them is so important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, in the family guide that I helped create for Feast, there's some like responses to be able to say if you're at the table and your anxiety is high or even your frustration. Like, we're human beings. It is so frustrating when you were like, you were just eating this $20 brand of yogurt that I just bought for you, you know? And so there's some ways to how to respond, what to say instead of, you know, like, how could you? Which is just kind of our normal reaction is we're frustrated. This is frustrating work. So.
Ah, like we couldn't, if you don't have those feelings, we can never understand what it's like for someone sitting in front of something that's so fearful. I used to say, think of your biggest fear in the world. Let's say you're absolutely petrified of spiders. You know, if that's something you're so scared of, well, you're asking your loved one to sit in front of spiders and touch them. right? Yeah. Yeah. If that was your case, what would you do first? Well, first you would probably sit with the spider, be in the same room. So think of those little steps that you would need to take. It's the same thing with a pea, right? Or, or whatever, a garbanzo bean, whatever it may be. So yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for really explaining that team, because, you know, back to it takes a village. It absolutely can take a village.
Absolutely.
So yeah.
It can take a village, and also can take a while. It can take a long time. We've talked about the setbacks and talked about how fatigued caregivers can get just every single meal, every single snack faced with this avoidance or resistance. I'm glad you brought up distress tolerance, Laura, because I guess across all eating disorders, that's one of the most helpful skills for parents, at least with anorexia, because that's what my lived experience is with. I was told this is a marathon, not a sprint, and you have to buckle in and just get ready. And that's why you especially need skills, coping skills. Is there a timeline for ARFID recovery? Is there a period of time that treatment typically takes, or is it just dependent on everything? And is there anything that can maybe speed it up or that slows it down?
Yeah, such a great question, and such a question that I get all the time. And I wish I had like this, if you go through this 6-week course, everything will be great. And that's just not the reality of the situation. You know, just like any other eating disorder, it depends on the severity. It depends on how long someone might have been struggling, how long someone's been avoiding, how far they are behind their growth and development. You know, treatment can, for some folks, it can take a few months. And for some folks, it's several years. It just kind of depends. You know, and I think that, you know, there's, I wouldn't say there's anything that can really speed it up other than making sure that, you know, early intervention is key. So the more, like, if you, you know, if you see something, say something. So if you see in, you know, your kiddos really like really pulling back on the food. So yeah, they've always been a picky eater, but now they're not eating, wow, like anything. So anything out of the major food groups. Now they're not eating any type of starches. So before, you know, they'll eat bread. They're okay with rice. They'll do pasta, but they won't, you know, okay, that's good. But now they won't do any starches. Or, you know, often what we hear, like, fats and proteins are the big ones that get avoided in ARFID. So now they're not doing any type of meat. You know, before we were able to get them to do ground beef. Now I can't get them to do anything, or I can't get any fats in them. You know, that's something that we really want to pay attention to, get some early intervention on, because we know, as we talked about earlier, the more malnourished, or the more they become, you know, they're falling off of their growth curves, they're really not meeting their nutritional status, the more anxious that brain becomes, and the scarier those foods become, and the more avoidant they will become. So, you know, that's what I would say. I don't think there's any magical thing that can speed things up, but certainly early intervention is key.
Great. Thank you.
And here's the $1 million question that people may want to know.
Okay.
At what point should caregivers consider a higher level of care for their loved one? It could be a partial hospitalization program, possibly inpatient. At what point would you say, yeah, I think that we need to do something a little more extreme here?
Yeah, I would say,
and if you, not extreme was the word.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's scary going to a higher level of care. It's scary dropping your kid off at a place you're not familiar with a bunch of people. You're trusting your kiddo in these people's hands. Like, that is terrifying. So the higher levels of care are absolutely scary. But also keeping your kid stuck in their eating disorder is also very scary. And also, you know, I think the big thing I would say is that if you're noticing no improvement in the growth and development, so like I said, the nutrition piece is the foundation. So if, you know, nutritionally, your kiddo's still struggling, they're not gaining weight, or they're continuing to lose weight, even after, you know, you've been to the pediatrician, they said, okay, let's do the dietitian. Let's try this for a couple months and see. If you're a couple months in and there's no improvement, there's no weight gain improvement, you know, there's no improvement with how they are responding maybe at the dinner table, you definitely want to start to look into that. If their eating, like I said, is getting to where they really don't have much of anything that they're eating anymore, definitely a higher level of care. if they're starting to get dependent on those supplements, like I talked about. So if they're getting dependent on Ensure, they're getting dependent, they'll only drink the one milkshake per day that you make for them. That's a problem, because that's just feeding into their avoidance, and it's making it harder and harder for their brain to be able to create a new experience around food if they're only eating the one thing or only drinking the one thing. Certainly medically, of course, if there's anything going on medically, low heart rate, abnormal vitals, abnormal labs, those are all higher levels of care, and that needs to be addressed immediately. So I think that's probably the biggest thing, is around the nutritional and the medical piece. If those two things are that worrisome, higher level of care is where you need to be.
Yeah. So important to understand how scary it is, and also not be afraid of doing it if your loved one needs it. And, you know, also, you know, when you're given that list of places, finding out, well, what do they do different than RFID? Or is my kiddo going to be in a group that everyone has anorexia, and then my kiddo is going to come in, and how are you going to treat that differently? I think that those would be reasonable questions for caregivers to, you know, to ask.
Yeah, and absolutely. And like I said, you know, we're doing more advocacy around eating disorders. Yeah. So I think people are starting to talk more about eating disorders, but RFID is still a little bit behind. So making sure that you're asking the treatment facility, what do you do for RFID, you know, and how do you address that differently? You know, in a group setting, you probably will have more folks who have other types of eating disorders. But that doesn't mean that we're not talking about the basic foundations of the same thing, where all of these disorders are rooted in avoidance, in anxiety, in getting distress tolerance skills. So still something to be gained from all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I say that to parents in support groups. If, you know, you'd have one family would come in whose kiddo has RFID, and, you know, the rest have other diagnoses. So like, well, I don't think this is for me. And I'd be like, do you get anxious, right? Like all those feelings are the same. It's just a little bit different, but all of that stuff is the same. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out.
I think today on this podcast, you've helped educate so many caregivers. And for me, that was so key at the beginning. It's such a steep learning curve. I had no idea anything at all about what anorexia was, what it looked like, what treatment looked like, what recovery looked like.
Yeah.
And just learning as much as you can, it gives you more confidence and empowers you so much as a caregiver. So everything you've provided today has been so helpful. I do feel like we only kind of scratched the surface, though, because there's 100%. So many details that we didn't go into. So we are going to definitely link in the show notes Natalia's webinar that she recently did for Feast about navigating nutrition when your loved one has RFID. She also has written a beautiful family guide. It's called Beyond Picky Eating, which is a lot of what we talked about today. Those will be in the show notes. I highly recommend both of those resources. I can't thank you enough for being here. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us at The Other Side of the Plate. If today's episode gave you hope or guidance, we invite you to explore more resources and peer support at feast-ed.org. Remember, you are never alone. For more conversations of hope and help for families facing eating disorders, please join us for our next episode.